Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 262, featuring Alkan Tan, who is the owner and founder of Gradient Effects and Secret Lab. Really cool podcast. And first of all, I have to apologize for the fact that this is coming out super last minute because I was on a little staycation last week. Did some fishing. I accrued too much vacation. I had to take some time off based on our wonderful reminder from our HR person, Liz. So thank you, Liz. But so we are putting this out super fast today. Kristen's going to help me out as my miracle worker. Tell me about some of the cool things you remember from this podcast with Alkan.
Well, I love that he kind of just took a leap of faith moving from Germany, right? Like,
yeah.
He kind of just like, I'm going to come.
Yeah.
That was awesome. And then he kind of thought he was getting stagnant in his career, stopped being innovative. So
yep.
He's like, got to get out of my comfort zone and I'll start my own company. And it might work, might not, and it did.
Yeah,
so,
it's really kind of cool that he did that. I mean, to give you guys a little bit of idea, Alkan comes from Germany. He worked in Germany for a while, and then he ended up at the Mill Film, back when Mill Film was still around in the UK, made the jump to the US and came to work for DreamWorks, and mm-hmm. that was pretty interesting. But that's when things started to get stagnant for him. So going from a German VFX company to DreamWorks to saying, the hell with it, I'll make my mm-hmm. own company. It's a pretty big step.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was really cool to see that. Yeah. What are some of the other things you remember about it?
Oh, my favorite was having your local pub, and that's where you get the best work done.
Right.
Which we know that too.
Like, we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have your little watering hole where sometimes you go there and you brainstorm a little bit, and mm-hmm. a lot of great ideas come out of there. And so, yeah, he had a place called, I think it was called The Other Door.
Yes, Other Room.
Other Room, right.
Venice.
Other Room in Venice on Abbot Kinney. I remember mm-hmm. that pub. For us, it was the Firehouse at Digital Domain. But yeah, it was really cool to have him on. One of the big things he discusses is some of the proprietary software and stuff that he's done specifically with de-aging. And we get really into that and some of the tools they use there. So very, very interesting stuff, especially towards the end of the podcast in terms of where Gradient Effects is going and Secret Lab is going. So pretty, pretty cool. All right. What's going on in terms of events?
All right. So we have Total Chaos coming up, and you can find this on chaosgroup.com/events or go to the Total Chaos website, which is chaosgroup.com/totalchaos. And it's going to be happening May 29th and 31st of this year. So go check it out. We're having more and more speakers come about each week. So
yeah, check out the website for sure. There's going to be mm-hmm. a lot of amazing speakers showing up this year. Every year we seem to outdo each other for Total Chaos. And I don't think this year is going to be any exception to that because it's going to be awesome. Mm-hmm. What other cool stuff should we tell people about?
Just to remind people, we now have a transcript page up so you can read all of these podcasts now. If you just go to the podcast page, it'll be up every week, the transcription.
Right. So mm-hmm. you'll see it in the player we have. You know, you can download the audio file, you can play it right from the player, or you can download the transcript of the actual podcast, which is a pretty cool thing. I didn't know that people would like it, but apparently people really like the transcript page.
Yeah. I'm
very happy for that. And then if people want to know more about us, where can they go?
Facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast.
Or
chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Perfect. And if you guys have ideas, we're always, always looking for ideas of people that can be on the podcast. Generally speaking, we always do it personally. We always do them in person. So if I'm going to a conference, I'll let you guys know. But if you know anyone who happens to be in the LA area, let us know and we'll be able to, would love to do a podcast with them if it's something that would be cool for you guys to listen to. So love to hear from you about that. Just email us labs@chaosgroup.com with your suggestions. All right. That being said, please enjoy this awesome podcast with Alkan Tan.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
This is very exciting. Thank you for making your way over to Culver City. Where are you guys in Santa Monica? Or
we're actually in Playa Vista.
Hmm. Okay.
Next to close where the Google building is.
Right.
The big one. Yeah.
Yeah.
The big where one. All the tech companies are now, like Yahoo is, or used to be. I don't know. I have to double check. But
right.
Riot.
Right.
Yeah.
Riot is over there now, right?
Exactly.
Digital Domain is not far from there.
No. We're right. Like around the corner.
Yeah. Okay.
Like 5 minutes from there.
Right, right, right. Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So, but let's talk about how this all started. So first, let's go to the backstory. You said you're from Germany, right?
Yes.
You're German.
Born and raised
in Germany. I've had several Germans on the show that have come through in the visual effects world, and I've always, when I first started in visual effects, I sat next to Rainer Gombosch at DD. So
right.
So Rainer and I were talking, and we're talking about all these Germans that got into visual effects, and there's a lot of them in Los Angeles. So what's your story? How did you get into it?
Wow. Okay. I started out, it sounds crazy, in 1993, too.
Okay. So and around Jurassic Park time?
Yeah. That was like one of the movies which I have seen and I was blown away by, because I always wanted to be a car designer.
Oh, right.
Because I'm from Frankfurt.
Frankfurt, okay. I was going to say you're either from Frankfurt or Stuttgart.
Frankfurt, Stuttgart, right. Berlin or Munich. And in Frankfurt, they had always international car exhibitions.
Yeah.
Like it was called IAA.
Uh-huh.
And there would be all the latest cars to see every
right.
2 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I would go there as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And we would be mesmerized by these new cars each year. That
right,
was
right.
like a thing to do. And I loved cars, so I always wanted to be a car designer. And then when I saw Jurassic Park, by then I'm already was playing around with, 3D software,
right.
trying to get into, designing stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I saw things suddenly moving in 3D.
Yeah.
And that was that just blew my mind.
Right.
And then I just got hypnotized. And then from then on, I'm like, this is what I'm going to do.
Okay. So you decided that's what you were going to do, but there must be a transition between that decision.
I was still at school. I mean,
you were still at school at that
time? I was still a student. Yeah, I was
right.
still at school. And I was then starting to look around, where can I do this? And there uh-huh. was the Film Academy in Stuttgart.
Yeah.
And I applied. Mm-hmm. It didn't work out for me.
Okay.
And I'm like, I'm not going to give up.
Right, right.
And then I looked for a company which was near Frankfurt, called Videocomp.
Uh-huh.
And they had an SGI sitting there.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And it was one of these machines back then you had to have to do 3D because everything else was incapable of running, productively.
Right.
And how do you get onto that machine? That was like this big question mark.
You get a job as an intern or something.
Yeah, but they were not looking for one.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I had to convince them they needed one.
Yeah. Yep.
And so I was calling them and pestering them. Hey, I want to be, working for you. I want to have, I want to learn this.
Uh-huh.
I need, can you just, hire me? You don't have to pay me.
Right.
I will just show up and do whatever you want me to do
mm-hmm.
just to earn the, right to sit on this machine.
Right.
And I did.
Yeah.
And I went there and I had to, the cables, clean things.
Yeah.
And eventually they made it, of course, not easy because they had other people who were, in front of the machine.
Mm-hmm.
And they would tell me, well, before you can use the machine, you need to know how to use Unix.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, great. So it's not going to be easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To get to the level where somebody is willing to let you use the machine.
Right.
So I had to prove them that I can operate the machine outside of using 3D, like a systems guy. So I started learning Unix and
right.
this and that. And eventually I got the chance to run the machine.
It was IRIX actually.
It was all IRIX. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had to also install.
So what were you using were you using Softimage or were you
I started with very much, it was also the time.
Or Alias, I guess, probably.
With Alias, yeah.
Yeah.
And they also they were also distributor back then for Lightwave on Amiga.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
They had that too. And Maxon was our next door neighbor.
Oh, right.
So
okay.
that was an Oberursel on this building. It was
uh-huh.
on the left-hand side, there was Videocomp
mm-hmm.
in the building, in this white building. And on the right-hand side, there was another white building. There was Maxon.
Okay.
That was like the German company very much.
Yeah, yeah,
who was
yeah.
doing Cinema 4D back then.
Right.
And which is now a big deal.
Now
back
big
then,
deal.
It was,
Yep.
Still in the infancy.
Yeah.
And it was a good software, but it wasn't well known like it's today. Nope.
Absolutely.
And so that's a small CG, I would say, corner in Frankfurt,
uh-huh.
where technology was invented next door. And I was sitting there, you know, like at Videocomp.
Yeah.
And Videocomp was selling these big SGI Onyxes to the German ZDF, RRD,
right.
Hessischer Rundfunk, which was like all based, I mean, in Frankfurt mm-hmm. and surrounding areas. And I mean, back then these machines were like, what, $2-3 million?
Mm-hmm.
And they would sell these machines to do like weather casts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was insane.
The big ones, the big refrigerators.
They're like refrigerators.
The purple refrigerators, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you could chain them together.
When my wife first learned the flame, she was doing it on one of those big purple refrigerators.
Yes. And then we had the Indigo. I can remember that one. It was like a coffee machine. That was one of the machines I started on,
mm-hmm.
Working on. And
same here.
And it would sound like you're cooking coffee all day long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yep. It was really funny. And no OpenGL shading, all wireframes.
Right.
So you had to quickly develop a sense for how lines look like. And you would constantly use the mouse to rotate your window.
So you could try to get some sense of parallax.
Parallax, right? Or as the line lays behind the front line. Or yeah. So that's how 3D was. And super slow. You know, and right. Of course, Polygon wasn't the preferred way on the software like Alias.
Yep.
It was all like NURBS modeling, spline.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started and I found myself quickly in a situation where the industry was so young mm-hmm. that I would go and teach other people who were clients of Videocomp.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes production companies would borrow me out. They bought the technology, but they had nobody to operate it mm-hmm. or use it
uh-huh.
and to execute their vision of yep. their clients. So they would call, they would buy the equipment, and then they would also ask, do you have somebody who can do the work? Now we have the hardware, but we don't have anybody who can use it.
Yep.
So, yeah, and eventually doing this for a couple of years, I met the people like Brett Peopler at NewTek, because I also was then teaching Lightwave for a little while.
Right.
When they were doing the transition from Amiga to Windows.
Yes,
and
yes, yes.
To the DEC Alpha Windows.
Yeah.
And for the first time, they had like Lightwave running on the iRix on the Indie.
Right. Oh, did they really have Lightwave running on an iRix machine?
Yes, they did.
Interesting.
And that was actually running pretty cool. I mean, I thought it was a really cool application next to Alias. Alias was like very hard to model with because of NURBS, especially yes. organic characters.
Well, I learned on Wavefront, which was even worse. So.
Yes. Just the interface.
Yeah, it's just
like typing.
The cube.
Yeah.
X157.
Exactly.
Oh my God. Yeah,
yeah,
it's horrible.
Maya still has that little window,
mm-hmm.
which is left over from Wavefront.
Mm-hmm.
And and eventually I made then, doing this then, like helping production companies, commercials,
mm-hmm.
I eventually made then the full transition into production. And I was still like, when was that, like 96? I just turned 20.
Okay.
I mean, I was a little kid running around, mm-hmm. you know, like doing this high-end thing.
Right, right, right.
On these $300,000 computers.
Right.
And then I ended up in 97. At my first Seagraph, actually NewTek invited me over
okay.
to be one of the demo artists at Seagraph 97.
Was in LA?
It was in LA. Back then it always was in LA. It didn't have different...
Yeah, but there was a couple of New Orleans and things like that.
I think that came afterwards.
Right.
I might
I was definitely at 97. I was at that Seagraph.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And I still have,
I think my first one was 95, so I was pretty close to you.
Yeah,
pretty close.
I think I'm like the 2 years later. That was
right.
my first, and I was so messed.
Well, that's a big trip to come all the way. From
yeah, and I just didn't know I came all by myself. I had nobody.
Wow. Okay.
So I was here.
You came on a whim. Yeah.
By myself, knowing I'm gonna do some demo work for NewTek.
Okay.
You know, on their stand, uh-huh. which I was doing, and then at the same time I had interviews with ImageWorks back then.
Yeah.
Here and there, but they all said I'm too young.
Right.
Wow. And And so I got...
They didn't say that. They said you don't have enough experience, is what they probably said.
Right. That's probably what it meant.
Yeah.
And then I got back to Germany and I did then a show called Helicops.
Okay.
Also all on SGIs.
Yeah.
That was done in Babelsberg.
Okay.
Helicops was the first like major CG TV show ever done in Germany where you had like CG helicopters flying around.
Okay.
And
was that done with, you said Lightwave?
Or? No, that was all on Alias.
It's all on Alias. Okay.
Yeah, that was the crazy part. I mean, it's all NURBS models.
Yeah.
So you had to be really good at NURBS modeling, surface layouts, which I call.
Right.
And you had to plan everything out properly. Animation was all done in it.
Right.
Rendering was all done. And, right. And we did, and it was like a small crew.
Uh-huh.
Hartmut Engel was part of it, one of the CG supervisors who did Independence Day.
Yeah.
And he very much also helped me get the job back then.
Okay.
And so we worked on this show for like 6 months in Babelsberg, completely run down back then.
Uh-huh.
It was still like really like the wall was down, what, like 7 years?
Okay.
Not even 6 years.
Right.
So everything is still like in the, like untouched the way it used to be in East Germany.
Right.
And it was slowly like things were starting to move in Babelsberg. It was regaining like you could see like it's like an elephant coming back up to life again.
Right, right, right.
And so we were in this rundown building. A company had rented that called Nitro Film, but they had this high-tech equipment there like Onyxes and all that.
Right, right.
And I was just like in my element.
You know, okay.
Like, I have all the things like, and so right after that, Hartmut, you know, like you have a mentor always when you're starting out.
Yeah.
And Hartmut was one of those people for me.
Yeah.
He then got a job offer since he worked on Independence Day to go to Oberhausen.
Okay.
And there they were doing a project called The 13th Floor.
Right.
That was...
Volker did that, didn't he?
Volker, they were like, they were not really.
They, okay.
He wasn't involved in the sense
of... The 13th Floor was the... Yeah, I remember that movie.
It's a Roland Emmerich movie,
yeah.
But he was more producing it.
Okay, that's
and
what
it was like in the... And it wasn't... He wasn't directing it, but he was like a creative advisor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Marco Weber was the producer.
Okay.
He did also Igby Goes Down.
Uh-huh.
And he was actually spearheading the whole thing.
Got it.
And Oberhausen had promised them to give them, I think they got some financial support. That's why it was landed there. And they had, for the first time in Germany, it's like, you have to imagine this is a very small town.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sitting this high-tech building with Onyxes, SGIs, like insane. And it's empty.
Right.
So that project was meant to be getting life into this investment. And so we all moved into the small town.
Right.
And
how big? I mean, like, what was the population approximately of this town? This can't be
It's not big. It's like Oberhausen. If you Google it, it's a really small town.
Interesting.
It's, I mean, there's Düsseldorf probably, the like, in, it's in this area where Düsseldorf is. And
right.
It's close also to the Netherlands, that area.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's a really small town.
Western Germany.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but Roland was interviewing people for the show with Marco in Cologne.
Oh, okay.
That's where they were set up in this hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And Hartmut Engel said, hey, I'm going to go there and I'm going to suggest the interview as well.
Okay.
And so we went there, we had our interviews, and I found later out that Marco Weber, the producer of the movie, very much hired me because he was intrigued that I was like such a young kid showing up on an interview like that, whereby the other team members were not so quite convinced. And he kind of overruled them and put and hired me into the team because he saw something in me. And we are still friends. He tells me. He told me the story years later, and he very much gave me my chance to show what I can do.
And, interesting.
So that's how I started then working on my first feature film.
Right, so 13th Floor.
You know, it's like knowing the right people at the right time.
Yeah.
And they, you know, when they, it's sometimes just fate.
Yes.
And
It's a little bit of talent too. Oh,
it probably helps.
Yeah, of course it does.
But I think back then, you know, it's like it's motivation. When you have motivation, yeah. You want to do something so much that talent then is maybe reflects to the outside world. You know, that intention transforms into talent eventually, I think.
Right.
And so I ended up working on the show, and I was in charge of doing the opening sequence, you know, like where the tram goes by with the full CG hotel. Right. And that hotel was miniature, but the trees were all full CG. And mm-hmm. That was done in the first version of Maya.
Wow. Okay.
Beta version. So we had Maya.
Maya 1.0.
Not even. It was completely beta. It was not.
But it didn't even. And it wasn't Windows either.
No, it's all iOS.
It was iOS.
Yeah,
right,
and right. All typing still. Like the old, the interface wasn't completely developed like we know it today.
Maya was the merger of Alias and Wavefront, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And then we were using Alias to model.
Right.
I had Studio Paint to texture paint.
Yeah.
Because Studio Paint is now called Sketch, I think.
Okay.
But you could bring in your 3D model.
Yeah.
And then you could, you know, like already paint on it.
Right.
That was quite. I think that was like 97, 98, right. You know, and if you think today, it's norm. But
right.
Back then, it was really unique. It was
revolutionary, yeah.
Yeah.
Painting on 3D was pretty big deal, yep.
And so we had Studio Paint, Alias, and first beta version of Maya.
Right.
And I never, in the beginning, I disliked Maya mm-hmm. because it was very limited. But
right.
Soon it turned out it was very powerful because it has this particle system which came from Wavefront, and
right.
You could write much more complicated expressions
mm-hmm.
and you could code stuff with Mail, automate stuff.
Yep.
So I found myself quickly in a situation that we had this motion control downstairs for our miniatures.
Oh.
And I had to do tracking with Equalizer and then take that data and turn that into motion control.
Right.
How you call it? Movements.
Movements. So you could take your data from Maya and take it to the motion control.
And then also program the motion control where we had the laser pen on the control arm to position and point with the motion control head where the models need to be in 3D space.
Oh, right.
So we could place them like we had, the layouts in CG so that we can replicate very much the position, you know, how high the model needs to be off the ground, because this was like an oil rig field.
Right.
And it was not a planar plane, so the models had to be arbitrarily spaced, like position in space.
That's cool to work on miniature stuff like that too.
So that was like, I found myself quickly out of the need of the project doing all these different things and gaining all that experience very
That's
quickly.
Awesome.
And I had great mentors too, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I had good people who were very helpful and pointing me into the right direction and helping me learn.
Yeah.
And there was our motion control guys. There was Joachim Grüninger.
Uh-huh.
He is like, we did the Patriot later on together for Roland as well.
Okay.
And he is a great motion control miniature VFX supervisor. I learned a lot from them.
Yeah.
Especially from him.
Right.
And Joe Bauer was also one of the VFX supervisors on the 13th floor.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's how I met Joe Bauer for the first time.
All right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
So that was like the early days.
Uh-huh.
And then I got the job offer from Das Werk mm-hmm. because they were setting up a feature film department.
Yeah.
And they expanded really fast. They had a lot of goals, and they bought up a lot of companies in Germany back then
mm-hmm.
and they were very much in every city, and they were doing German movies first
mm-hmm.
and then so the German European co-production deals, they found themselves on a project called Enemy at the Gates.
Okay.
And for that we rented a gas station like a not functioning gas station in Düsseldorf and set up a VFX facility there.
Okay.
Because Nordrhein-Westfalen, that's the state, was financing it.
Okay.
Like giving it tax credits.
Right.
So that the work had to be done there. So what they did is they very much shipped us and shipped us into this different city where we had no friends, nobody we knew,
mm-hmm.
and had to start very much a new life for the period of the project.
Wow. Okay.
And that's how I met Peter Chang, because he was overall VFX supervisor over at Double Negative.
Yeah.
We had someone from the mill over there
who
was doing, was like at us with us doing like compositing. That was back then, it was on Shake. And I was like the CG supervisor, so to say, for Das Werk in Düsseldorf.
Right.
And then we started writing tools for how glass can break.
Okay.
And so we wrote a whole like MEL-based and C-based, C++-based system where like you have falling glass in the movie and how it breaks into pieces, into like sub-pieces. And that was like a new... And we called that nested rigid bodies.
Mm-hmm.
That was like us playing around and coming up and with these ideas. And I'm mentioning that because eventually that turned into tools we I used at Mill Film on Tomb Raider and Black Hawk Down.
Okay, yeah.
And so there, after we were done with the movie, I had this British guy very much telling me that the Mill Film is hiring.
Okay.
And I should, you know.
You should go to London.
And I should give it a go.
Right.
They need talented people, he said. And I'm like, okay, London, should I? I don't know. English.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Should I, you know, it's also different. And right. Why not? This sounds to be the right thing. And they just had, you know, like also done Gladiator, I think, or we're doing it. So it was, in Europe, they were like, I would say, the VFX house who was doing some, the closest thing to what Hollywood was doing.
Sure.
So instead of moving to LA, that was like, hey, you know, plane flights are like 2 hours. It's manageable.
Right.
So so I got the job over at Mill Film, and then found myself, you know, like working with a whole group of young people who were we're all about the same age.
Right.
It was because London was just developing. It wasn't really like
it was still young.
In place. We all were like young kids.
What year is this approximately?
This is like, let me just think. This is now 2000 to 2001.
Right.
Somewhere there.
Yeah.
And we were like, they were working on Tomb Raider when I came in.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so excited. It's characters, you know, Render Man and we were on Windows at that point because I think SGI was already no longer the relevant.
Yes.
It was all Windows Deck Alpha, not Deck Alpha, Windows. There was this Intergraph machines.
Yeah.
So they were all now Intergraph machines at this point, and we hated Windows. So everybody had like Unix shell installed so we can continue using Unix shell because that's what we were used at this point.
Right.
And I ended up, because we had done... I had done the Breaking Glass for Enemy at the Gates, taking all these ideas and writing a plugin for Maya in C and C++ for Tomb Raider, how all these stone characters are falling in these pieces.
Oh, right.
Fully procedural.
Right.
We modeled the pieces back then, all in NURBS.
Right. So you modeled it completely broken up.
Yes. And I had a friend who is a fantastic character designer today. His name is Nick Lloyd. He was sitting next to
me. I know Nick.
Nick is a really good friend. We spent like, I would say, in the trenches together.
Nick, he's at DD. He was at DD.
Yeah,
I know Nick very well.
He's a really good friend, and we became really good friends since then.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, and because he was, that was all done in NURBS.
Right.
So we would have scan models from the creatures.
Uh-huh.
He would then go back in.
Yep.
And then remodel the whole thing in NURBS.
Yep.
And then use like texture reprojection for displacement maps so we can get the details back.
Yep.
It was a whole insane process.
I did something similar with him on iRobot. So on iRobot, we were breaking up and doing the damage levels for the robots and all this different stuff. And texture exchange.
Yeah. So while he was doing that, I was writing this tool where you could select an arm of the character and then it would build you an arrow where the impact point comes from. You could rotate that, and if you release it, it would then set up
the explosion.
The explosion. Right. It would put in the time and the impulse values.
Right.
And then if you hit simulate, it would run the simulation.
Right.
And you would have your character break in pieces
mm-hmm.
and in smaller pieces. That was like, you know, the only comparable thing we had seen was like a mummy back then.
Right.
Where it would crumble.
Yes.
And so we were now doing something which we thought, you know, ourselves, how are we going to do this? And we were making it a reality just by believing in that we can do it.
Right, right, right.
And so, yeah, that was like the first project over there, which I was being thrown into, and I found myself developing this tool. And it was not like somebody assigned me that directly. It was really like, I think I can do this, and I'm going to do a test. And I did the test, and then people saw the test. My supervisor, Carl Mooney, was supervising the show. Mm-hmm. And once I presented him what I was doing,
yeah,
he became really supportive of it.
Nice.
You know, they gave me the freedom to continue.
Right.
And then eventually we did this whole sequence where Angelina Jolie is destroying these characters and pieces. And this was in 2001, and there was nothing like that.
Right.
I mean, Houdini couldn't do that.
Right, yep.
You know, we had Houdini artists in town when we would go out to the pubs. Mm-hmm. You know, like, of course, we are like, I mean, when you're a young kid, you're like a little bit like, yeah, I did, you know, like proud about your stuff.
Right.
And it's your first achievements, mm-hmm. right? And we would have Houdini artists asking us, hey, how did you guys do that? And we are like, ha, it's all in Maya. We write our own software.
Right, right.
Which we did, but it was feeling good that you could do something, you know.
Sure, like, sure, sure. And especially Houdini people who are always doing the effects anyway.
Exactly. It's always done in Houdini, and there you are, you have done something in Maya.
Right.
Which Houdini can't do.
Right. Yeah. If you'd done it in Max, you would have just pissed everyone off.
Probably. I don't know. So that was actually quite cool. And then what happened is the next project was Black Hawk Down.
Right.
And there was a helicopter crash going on. Mm-hmm. And because of the tool I had developed for Tomb Raider, it turned out to be a perfect application for these rotor blades mm-hmm. hitting the ground.
Right.
And since I also had programmed the motion control in Germany at Enemy at the Gates, I had a good understanding of how to now combine simulation, motion control, and model movers.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Tim Burke, who was the overall VFX supervisor, and Emma Norton was the VFX producer for Milfilm. We were discussing the sequence, how we can do it, and mm-hmm. he empowered me very much, you know, like to be very much his assistant throughout the shoot, mm-hmm. and then later on we were working together on how to do like the simulation and how to put that onto the motion control rig. So I was like with Tim throughout the whole process, and
right.
And then later on, even in the studio, you know, like I was combining the motion control now with, you know, like the results, then again with the CGI.
Mm-hmm.
And Milfilm was the place to be for me.
Right.
But then after that, they closed.
Right.
Because they decided that film is not the place to make money with.
Right. So they focused on commercials.
They then pulled completely back. Mm-hmm. And I thought we were doing so great. I'm working for my dream company.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like we're building something here in London and hasn't done before. We are all young and motivated. And then it just got shattered.
Right.
So I found myself like now looking for another job.
Right.
And London can be competitive because we are all like most people were, you know, very young.
Right.
When this all happened, like we all like in our 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And different companies had different, or early 30s, different companies mm-hmm. had different people who were their core teams. Mm-hmm. And they would be very protective.
Right, right, right.
So like somebody coming from the outside, like becoming part of a core team was always a big deal.
Yep.
So I ended up working for MPC Commercials.
Okay.
And then I couldn't really found fulfillment mm-hmm. doing commercials. And I always wanted to be back in feature film. Mm-hmm. At that time, I also had DD making me job offers mm-hmm. and DreamWorks, ImageWorks. And so that was the first time when I decided, hey, I might want to go to LA because Milfilm doesn't, it's no more, you know, and becoming part of a new core team, it's not that simple.
Yep.
And so I had an interview with Ann Daly, and Ann Daly is very much running DreamWorks Animation back then.
Okay.
With Jeffrey Katzenberg together.
Right.
She then invited me over to LA.
Yeah.
Because they had seen my work or have scouted me out. So some people, headhunters.
Once you start doing little weird things like relicing your own tools and stuff like that, you start to pop up on people's radars.
Yeah, right? That's kind of what happened. Yeah, they have really scouting for that between artists. And and that's how they found me. Mm-hmm. And then I found myself sitting very much first at Artman Studios one morning talking to Ann Daly.
Uh-huh.
And she was showing me the artwork of the next animation project.
Yeah.
And that they think, also explaining me, they thought I was be a good fit for effects development because they thought I can write software, but I'm also artistic because I can bring both together.
Yes.
And they had these
positions. Which is a really special skill back then, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it still is.
Still is, yeah.
Yeah. And they called them effects developers.
Okay, yeah.
Because it meant you are creating the effect, but you're also creating the code. To create the effect. So you have to have the vision and the skills to write the code to get what they're looking for.
Right.
So I ended up then interviewing with Jeffrey. And I mean, when you interview with somebody like Jeffrey Katzenberg and you're sitting in front of him, he says, we want you to work for us. You just say yes.
Sure.
It's just like, again, you're like, okay, what can you say? You
know? Right.
I mean, so I then came to LA very much.
Okay. So where were you working?
In Glendale.
In Glendale,
yes.
Okay.
I got hired into Glendale, not San Francisco.
Yeah.
That was also a difficult time back then because you had PDI just merged with DreamWorks.
Right. That's what I was getting at.
And they had like a little bit of a like competition going on between Glendale and DreamWorks.
Uh-huh.
PDI.
Yeah.
A team, which was now all part of
DreamWorks.
That's DreamWorks, yeah. And so I started, my first task was to work on Over the Hedge. And I was in charge of redesigning the foliage system.
The foliage, yeah.
Yeah, because the one they had before, it was more a script.
Right.
And they needed something much more bigger, sophisticated.
I think that movie is really funny and people should revisit that movie because it's really funny.
Yeah, I think it was one of the better ones. Yeah.
It's really good movie. I haven't thought about it for a while until you brought it up. But yeah, if you guys go check out Over the Hedge because it's basically a story about wild animals that live on one side of the hedge and then domesticated animals on the other side of the hedge, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was a fun project.
Right.
And but I started missing live action.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So. After being there for about 3 years, I decided to I miss live action. I want to do, you know, like filmic. And
but you've always been in the 3D world at this point.
CG.
Right?
I always been
always
CG.
Been CG, right?
Yeah, yeah. CG and then miniature motion control.
Right.
You know, like through the other projects I worked on, and then I said to myself, I want to do my own company.
Okay.
Before I turn 30 and and have kids and become unflexible. Yeah. Now it's the time to risk it.
So because in Los Angeles at this point.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just me and I can't hurt anyone if something goes wrong, only myself.
Okay.
You know, homeless in LA.
Yeah.
I'm going to try it. And so Marco Weber. Then helped me out. That's the producer who had hired me back in 1998.
Right. I remember, yeah.
Yeah. Who was doing 13th Floor.
Right.
So he had a production.
So he was in Los Angeles.
He was in Los Angeles. He has a production company here. So I called him up and said, hey, Marco, I need help.
Okay.
I want to do this my own company. Okay. I need a little bit of support here and there. And can you hire me while I figure this out? Because I have to leave DreamWorks to do this.
Right.
But you might need help with your current projects. So I started working as his VFX supervisor while he let me figure out how to set up my own company.
Okay.
Which I then did.
That's really nice.
Yeah, he was really supportive.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And then in 2006, I end of 2005, beginning of 2006, mm-hmm. we then, I eventually set up Gradient Effects. Gradient Effects.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what I was getting into.
Yep.
Because working somewhere, I joke that was like a golden cage.
A golden cage?
Yes. Because you're like, when you run your own company now, it's the jungle. You can get eaten anytime by a wild animal. You don't know where it's coming from.
Right.
When you're working for somebody, especially like a big Pixar or DreamWorks, mm-hmm. you have this make-believe world. Everything is great.
Yes.
You're in this cage and you're being like protected from the elements outside.
Yep.
And, but it can happen that that cage can be pulled off anytime.
Right.
There's no guarantee for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it can also, I notice, make people comfortable. Like I got comfortable.
Right.
And when you get comfortable, you stop innovating.
Right.
And I found quickly out that running your own company or building your own company is super competitive. The competition out there is super tough.
Yep.
And you have to be innovative.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, my experience was very similar around the same time that you're talking about. I was at Sony.
Yeah.
And it's a huge company. It was at the time, there was 1,000 people that were working in the facility in Culver City.
Yeah, right? I remember.
Yeah, it was crazy big. And yeah. and there was a lot of like, well, if it ain't broke, we're not going to fix it. And I'm like,
yeah.
But like it sounds like I was very much in the same attitude as you. It was like, I came into visual effects to do cool new stuff.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make new things. And like the whole point of visual effects is to make something you've never seen before. So you have to innovate things. You have to try new things. And it was like, nah, we're just going to retire, you know? And that was not satisfactory to me. That's why I left. So
yeah.
Sounds like I left and I went to work for a small company that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But that's a different story. But it sounds to me like you said, I'm leaving the very comfortable DreamWorks
yeah.
and start my own company. That's a huge step.
Yeah. I people thought I'm crazy because they said, you're coming all the way from Germany. And, you know, you have to think about when you come 15,000-20,000 miles
yeah.
to start a new life. You're coming to work for a company who you believe, you know, like it's taking care of you.
Right.
It's like now you are like, how you call it, guardian, so to say.
Right.
At least it's how it feels.
Right.
But then you realize when you work, you know, like there's the corporate culture, things are not going fast enough. And I've always been a fast thinker.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt so much put into, I would feel like put in a corset, is that the right word?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where you can't move.
Or a straitjacket.
Straitjacket, but like intellectually.
Right.
Yep. You're not allowed to do things because it doesn't fit the bigger picture.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it could have been actually really good for the company.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing I did is I started using Python.
Oh, right.
At DreamWorks.
Yeah.
And I got in trouble for it.
Yeah, because they were using Perl or something.
No, it was called Script.
Just Script. Okay. Yeah.
And it wasn't even working. It had no garbage collectors, nothing.
Right.
And so that's why I started using in this Foliage system, Python as the new scripting engine.
Right.
And I remember I got in trouble for that.
Yeah.
That was not a good thing to do.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't Script.
Right. Yeah.
The in-house scripting language.
I had to use Burps at Sony to do all the lighting on Ghost Rider, and it was painful. And I was like, well, that's our standard. And it's like, but it takes forever. And goes, okay, well, you're getting paid, so what are you worried about?
That's exactly what I was like,
no, this is not the right attitude.
Yeah, because we are doing this, the extra hours, the long hours, because we are motivated. It's not just for money.
Right, I know.
It's for, you know, like we are trying to create something because we're excited about it. We want to break new grounds and stuff like that. So I thought I could probably do that through my own company much more freely.
Yeah. That's great.
And yeah, but I didn't really knew what I was really getting into.
So yeah, well, who does?
But that was a good thing because
if you've known, you wouldn't have done it. You've been scared to do it.
I'd probably not doing it.
Right.
I would have not done it.
Okay, well, you did it. So now it's been a while, right?
Yeah, it's been now close to 14 years. Next year will be 15.
Yeah.
Let me just calculate. Yeah, 21, it will be 15 years.
Right. That's amazing.
So.
That's amazing.
And but I can tell you the first 10 years were just hard work. It's that's why I always joke, building a company, it's like kids, like you have a young child. Mm-hmm. First 2 years, it can't speak.
Yep.
And then it can barely walk and it falls and you have to always help and get it up. Mm-hmm. And it's not supporting you, you're supporting it.
Right.
It's quite the opposite way.
Yep.
And it's about the same timeline too. You know, right. Like when they get 8, 9, they start to become more, you know, like sophisticated.
Right.
With 10, 11, they seem to be now.
They can do more.
They can do more things.
More advanced mathematics.
Yeah, they can do things independently now.
Yeah.
Yep. A company is very much the same thing.
Yeah, you don't need a babysitter anymore.
Yeah. And when you do your own company, you are the person who in the beginning has to put so much energy in.
Yeah.
And that is the most difficult part, I think.
So what were some of the first big projects that your company got involved with?
We did projects like The Box. I have to go back quite a bit in memory lane. Huh. Our first project was a project we did, Chocolate, it was called. It was like with vampires.
Okay.
And we did we had our own fluid solver.
Oh, okay.
I had custom developed.
Uh-huh.
And it could do cold breath. And that was a unique thing.
Yeah.
Because there was no fluid solvers in any other software.
Yeah.
It was like a full-on volumetric solver with mental ray shaders and all that. We were using mental ray back then.
Mm-hmm.
And until 2010, 11, I think.
Okay.
So even 12. Yeah. It was all mental ray based at our company.
Okay.
With our custom shaders.
Right.
And so Blood Chocolate. Now I got it. That was our first project.
It was a vampire film.
It was like a vampire. Yeah. Like not a big budget.
Sure.
And who was it? I forgot the a production company, but it was it was called Blood Chocolate.
Interesting.
Yeah, Framestore was on it, and then we were like, you know, taking very much
secondary effects
yep. just to get in the work and to stay busy. And we started out on Abbott Kinney.
Oh right, okay.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, next to PLF probably.
PLF actually gave us the space.
Oh okay.
Yeah. They play
and a big Blur was across the street, I guess, or not far from there.
Blur was not far from there.
Yeah, yeah.
And PLF actually helped us very much in the very beginning.
Interesting.
They had these two spaces, one on the right that was all PLF themselves, uh-huh. and then one on the left. There was another office space, two floors.
Right.
They were renting that out. And I started with one office in there. And then at the end, we rented out the whole building on the left side of it. And then we outgrew it.
The head of founder of PLF was on this podcast as well. So,
yeah.
Did you know Ben Proctor as well? He was a PLFer. That's where I met him. I didn't go to PLF.
I met Ben.
Help
me out with the founder's name. My brain just froze.
Green.
Colin.
Colin Green.
Yeah, Colin. We go way back because of that.
Right.
Like, I mean, I met Colin in 2006.
Yep.
When we very much, I met. Actually, he was recommended by a friend. I forgot who and he very much helped me with the space.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
He didn't have to rent out space.
Right.
But he still rented it out.
Right.
And that's how I started out. I had one desk, which I bought from Craigslist. I had $5,000 investment in there. And I had a partner. Was also a reason. We were two people when we started out, Thomas Tanberg and myself.
Uh-huh.
And then he was a VFX supervisor on Blood Chocolate.
Uh-huh.
So there was like a little bit the benefit of that we could do overflow work because of that through Gradient to begin with. And then we did another project called The Box for Richard Kelly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And we did like a two-phase kind of effect where we removed half of a face of one of the lead actors.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That was in 2009. Nice. That was like one of our bigger projects. And then tax credits happened in Vancouver.
Right. Yeah.
And the financial crisis started to kick in.
Yep.
Then the next 2 years were quite difficult.
Really?
Yeah.
But you managed to stay around, right?
Yeah, we managed.
So what were the things that helped save you through that process? There must have been some shows that are like just kept your...
It's really a persistency, I think.
Right.
You know, not giving up.
Yeah.
And I mean, you always have sleepless nights when you run your own company.
Yeah.
With all the responsibilities. And at the end of the day is persistency.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what really helped us is, you know, we can always jump on the machine ourselves.
Right.
And since, all the way today, I'm always involved in the creative.
Okay.
Like how we go about the show, how we do things.
Sure.
And develop the tools. But I tend to hire people who get more the framework, and then they can fill in the missing parts.
Right.
So.
That's pretty cool. Well, that's amazing. Almost 15 years, that's pretty good. From, you know, a desk on...
Yeah,
from Craigslist and a small office in Abercrombie.
That's yeah, and our second office was the other room.
Oh, right.
Because you have to have a pub where you go to,
yes.
Like in London. You know, one thing we took away from Millfilm was, or at least I did, is you had to have your local pub.
Yes, you have to have that.
That was the other room for us.
Right. Oh, wait. Okay. So you were next to the other room?
Yeah, we were just like around the corner. So work, and then we would go to the other room to have our business meetings.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, business meetings.
Especially on nice days.
When I was at DD and I was supervising, because we had several buildings and stuff, and the soups were always running around, they gave us walkie-talkies to communicate. And then we would have meetings at the Flame Bay 13, which was the firehouse.
Oh, of course. I know the firehouse days.
Yeah.
I have a couple of – I mean, you know Jan Walter?
No.
Yeah, he was at DD. He was one of the engineers. And then Remy Torre.
Oh, yes. No, yeah.
He's a good friend.
Remy, yes.
Yeah, Remy.
Yeah.
And we'd all hang out together at the firehouse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Remy's... He left the industry completely, decided to become a doctor or something.
Like, he did, and now he's in Japan somewhere.
Yes.
And, he's a pilot, too.
He's
in Japan, doing computer games, I think. He's a very clever guy. I mean, he was doing a lot for Nuke.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Very smart
He's
guy.
still
very clever. Funny guy, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Very funny, yeah.
So... You see, the industry is quite interesting. And and then Marcos was at ImageWorks doing like the renderer for ImageWorks animation. Yep. I don't know if you remember Solid Angle. And then it's Arnold, world famous.
Marcos has been on this podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
we were like a small group of people who would always hang out together, especially. Yep. It was actually quite interesting times.
Mm-hmm.
And
That's fun. Well, cool. All right. So I do want to talk a little bit about de-aging stuff, because that came up in some of your work recently, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us about the project, first of all.
We worked on a TV show for HBO called The Righteous Gemstone.
Yeah.
And the show in the beginning had the goal to take John Goodman and make him about 20 years younger. Because they have a flashback episode.
Right.
20. And they were, you know, worried that that's not going to be that easily doable.
Yep.
For the budget, especially.
Yes.
I mean, you can do a lot these days as long as you throw money on it. But
yes.
But the question is, can you do it with your means, your means?
Right.
And so we got kind of involved when they were exploring and doing tests in town.
Mm-hmm.
And by then, I already had, you know, like since this is actually who we are like, I guess it has to do more with me, who I am. And that's why it reflects in my company.
Yeah.
Is we write always our own tools or try to, I mean, we are not just wasting time.
Yeah.
We look out there. If a tool doesn't exist, we will write it ourselves.
Right.
So I had written this tool over the last 8 years called Shapeshifter.
Uh-huh.
And we used it on The Revenant to make DiCaprio skinnier. For example, lose weight, and on a couple of other projects, like we made on Tarzan, there was a flashback sequence. We developed it originally for that, where we were pitching on it to make both Margot Robbie skinnier.
Okay,
and what's this? The other counterpart in Tarzan who's playing the role again, the tall Swedish. I forgot.
I don't remember. Yeah.
We made him skinnier too, but at the end we lost the work to another vendor because of relationships they had. They had stronger relationships than we did. But the outcome was we had this tool now.
Right.
And then we used it on The Revenant.
Uh-huh.
And now here comes a TV show. And we use it all the time on our Marvel shows.
Okay.
Like where we have similar stuff sometimes we have need to do. And
now you're making people skinnier. Is that mainly for like beauty work or is it plot specific?
Plot specific most times. Yeah. Okay. And so in Gemstone, and we are like on The Revenant, we were not supposed to talk about it.
Right.
We have, and it hurt us really bad because as a smaller company, if you can't speak about your work, you're losing potential clients.
Sure.
We were like, you know, like there was, they didn't promote it like The Bear. They didn't let us speak about it because they were like talking to everyone in the industry that everything was shot in camera in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah. If they could say The Bear was shot in camera, they would have said that.
I know. And it's so it was very interesting because I was at the Bake Offs for The Revenant.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember them saying, yeah, we're barely able to talk about this because they want to make everyone believe that this was all in camera. But all the backgrounds were done this way. Like so much was done in CG.
Yeah. And we did 33 minutes of the movie.
Why is it such a bad word?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I can't understand that quite. And I think
this was during the Life of Pi, like aftermath, you know?
I just can think of, we might be scaring people. They don't want to talk about their scares.
Yeah, I guess so. Anyway, so you did how many minutes of The Revenant?
We did 33 minutes of the movie.
That's amazing.
Yeah. There was ILM, us, Cinecide.
Right.
And I think MPC was part of it too. And and at that point, I had formed a second company called Secret Lab.
Yeah,
focusing on feature film and R&D.
Yeah.
And so Shapeshifter was used right away.
Yeah.
To, you know, make Leonardo more skinnier because he was supposed to be in the, you know, weeks in the like in the open nature, and now he's back in the fort, and he didn't look skinny enough for somebody who has spent, you know, without eating food
for so long
in the in the open nature for so long, and so that was our first bigger use of the technology, and then since we don't market so much, we haven't used it in a while. And there comes Gemstone along. Mm-hmm. And we are like, hey, great, that's Gemstone. They want to do it on a whole episode. Shapeshifter was designed for rapid, you know, like it's rapidly applying this type of effect.
Right.
And let's do a test.
Okay.
So we told production, start the watch.
Yeah.
Give us the material.
Right.
And then when we send the work to you, stop the watch.
Okay.
Yeah. You cannot just judge like the quality of the work by the end product. You need to measure the in-betweens, you know, when how long it takes, what does it mean if you have a whole show like that.
Right.
So we started that, we turned that around in a couple of days, send it back. And then they were like, oh, this looks awesome.
Right.
And then they said, that's a great idea that you guys are doing a test. Let us get some other tests.
Okay.
So then they reached out to other companies in town.
Yeah.
And then 2 weeks later, again, we get another call and it's like, your process is like, you know, it's exactly what the filmmakers want.
Yep.
They really are convinced about this.
Okay.
Can you come over? And I was working with Peter Crossman and he invited me over for a couple of days on set and we didn't use 3 camera setups.
Right.
It's just all 3 camera.
Yeah.
And no markers on the face.
Yeah, I know.
And
there was a lot of fluff in that piece.
So when we do R&D, we focus on the essentials.
Right.
And running a company also means you understand the fact, what it means, you know, how you need to reduce the process to a level where it makes business sense.
Right.
So in Shapeshifter, we try to bring all that together.
Right.
And like reducing makeup time is a big deal.
I mean,
not only budgetarily, but also for the mood of the actors.
Yeah, I mean,
you don't want them to sit for hours in makeup and then come out and they're out of their muse, you know?
Right.
Now they have to get them back together, motivated.
Yeah.
So we very much did in about 8 weeks, 7 to 8 weeks, 30 minutes of poor de-aging footage.
Right.
And I mean, 30 minutes of John Goodman in a 40-minute episode.
Right, that's a lot.
And I was surprised myself mm-hmm. how well it was translating on a large scale like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the cool thing was, we were not even aware what's happening in parallel in the industry while we were doing this.
Right, right.
For us, we were just doing
you
our jobs.
You didn't know about the Irishman going on
not
at the same time.
Not really. Yeah. I mean, we just found out much later that all those things were happening.
Yeah.
So, and actually, it wasn't even us who brought up, we didn't even promote it ourselves. It mm-hmm. was coming more from Roadhouse.
Okay.
The production company yeah. and HBO. They were like, hey, we have done this too.
Right, yeah,
and then
yeah.
I got then a phone call through their introduction from The Atlantic.
Right, okay.
Because they were making this big piece.
Nice.
And then suddenly it started to unravel itself.
Well, this is cool because, I mean, right now, obviously, the aging is going to become a big thing, right? And it's...
I think it's like... It's one of these things where people are realizing it's possible now. And they are yeah, starting so to use it as a storyline.
Storyline. But they always, I mean, people like, it's like, why is everyone doing this? It's like, well, because it's possible, right?
And yeah.
The flashback sequences.
They happen all the time.
They happen all the time.
Exactly.
And so, you know, and if you can get someone to look 20 years younger to make that flashback sequence work, yeah. and it works. So I think it's really cool. I think it's interesting to see all these different techniques, yeah. right? From the very... overly engineered systems to the very simple systems, you know?
I have a very simple way.
Very manual systems sometimes, you know?
Yeah, I keep it simple.
Yeah.
That's always the methodology. I have a rule at my company when we do research.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't come up with an idea which makes sense mm-hmm. in like a reasonable time,
yep.
right, then it's a bad idea.
right.
If you're thinking too hard, if you're considering something and you're trying to make it work for too long, and that means you're working too hard on something which is not meant to be.
Right.
So if it doesn't resolve itself, then you're on the wrong path.
Right, right, right.
You know, you're on the right path when you find answers quickly.
Yeah.
Then things seem to be more reasonable and doable and executable than things which are just a pipe dream.
Yeah.
And you can get lost quite quickly in such situations when you have people who haven't, you know, especially in the R&D field, when you you don't have, how you call it, vision, I think,
yeah.
how it comes together at the end.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that can cost a lot of money, a lot of time, and tends to lead to over-engineered solutions.
yep.
So.
Indeed. Well, listen, I know you've got another meeting to get to, and we're just about an hour. But so far, it's been an amazing conversation. Can you tell us about some cool projects coming up or where people can get more information about your company? And
yeah, I mean, on our webpage.
Yeah.
And currently, we are bidding on shows.
Okay.
And, I mean, we usually, it's hard to say what we're working on currently because a lot of the stuff is very, how you call it, sensitive.
Sure, of course.
You know, even though if I would say what we are working on, it might lead to conclusions what will be in the show.
right.
You know, and I'm trying to avoid any kind of...
But is there something coming out soon that you can say, oh, this is going to be, you know, look out for our stuff, or just go to your website and check it out?
I mean, currently we are, we have a lot of, it seems to be there's a lot of interest with our de-aging.
Mm-hmm.
And then we are working on... our regular type of effects work.
Okay.
A lot of the stuff is filming mm-hmm. right now. And so we are in the stages of, how you call it, pre-planning.
Yep.
So I can't really,
can't
really go.
Don't say
too
anything.
Much.
That's fine. It's absolutely fine. It sounds very exciting though. And it's really cool that you guys are still based in LA and you guys are doing some amazing work here. Right in the Playa area, which is a yeah. great little technology hub these days, right?
It is, yeah. Oh, I like the area.
Good internet speeds around there.
Oh, yeah. We have Spectrum is our provider because yeah. We are very much encircled by them.
Right, 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 which is great. Well, thank you so much for doing this. It's been great.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.